or just write in the chat, because I can see it on my screen. I'm always looking to see if there's anything going on like that, but I don't anticipate any problems. So welcome, everyone, to week one of Santa Claus Economics. And I thought, in light of the fact that we're experiencing a galloping explosion of welfare statism with healthcare and many other things, and it's the Christmas season, I thought it would be appropriate to take a look at some of the Austrian School of Economics literature and other literature that's compatible with the Austrian School of Economics on the sort of something for nothing economics, which really is what the welfare state is all about. Okay, and those of you who haven't taken a Mises Academy course yet, you'll find out that Cam Ray is an incredible assistant, in that almost simultaneously when I mention a book or an article, he'll dig up the link somehow and it'll appear on the chat almost instantaneously. I don't know how he does it. But and so we're going to spend the next four weeks. The format is usually I give about a 45-50 minute talk, and then I do my best to answer any questions that you have in the chat for another half hour or so, or however long the class wants to do it. There is a limit, of course. And if you don't have a lot of questions, well, you don't have a lot of questions. But I'll be glad to do my best to answer whatever questions you have, offer reading suggestions, and feel free to email me also, my private email, tdlo@aol.com. And if you have any questions, in addition to the actual site, the Mises Academy site for this class, you can put questions there during the week and so forth. And usually I have a couple of quizzes. For those of you who would like a grade, I'll make up, this is a four-week class, so at the end of the 4 weeks, I'll make up an exam. It'll probably be a true and false exam. And so in addition to your certificate, online certificate from the Mises Institute, certificate of completion, you'll get a grade on it if you would like a grade. If you don't want a grade, that's fine. You don't need to have a grade. You can just do it pass-fail. And so that's the format. Okay, well, might as well get started then with the substance. And in the first article, one of the first articles that I put on the syllabus was by Ludwig von Mises. And he talks in it about destructionism in the context of the welfare state and of other types of intervention, government interventions. And by destructionism, he's talking about the agenda, the ancient agenda of socialists to destroy the existing society, and especially to destroy the capitalist institutions along with the civil society. After all, the Communist Manifesto itself had, and there are several places in it that had big black capital letters, and one of them was abolition of private property, and the other was abolition of the family. Those two things were big capital bold-faced letters in the Communist Manifesto. And that has always been the agenda of Marxists of all kinds. And that's what Mises is referring to when he talks about destructionism. And he talks about such things, various labor policies first, and then he also talks about the welfare state as an attempt to destroy, especially the work ethic. One of the most important aspects of a capitalist economy is the desire to work. Because you know that if you work hard in a private property capitalist economy, you can progress economically and socially. You have an incentive to acquire new skills and better skills, because you can see that by acquiring those skills and becoming more productive as an employee or as an entrepreneur, you can prosper, your family can prosper. And so the welfare state, Mises saw as an attack on that whole ethic, the work ethic. And also, it also is attached to the idea that Marxism or socialism always downplayed the role of capitalism in reducing poverty, diminishing poverty, and in funding charities for the poor of all kinds. And on this topic, the connection between capitalist economic growth and the growth of charities, it brings to mind to me another book that I'll throw out. by Richard McKenzie. It was called What Went Right in the 80s. And I'm not referring to the entire book, but one of the things in that book that is memorable and is associated with this class is McKenzie gathered some data on the increases and decreases over time of charitable contributions in the United States over the business cycle. And not surprisingly, he found that when there's economic growth, there tends to be a growth of charitable donations and vice versa. And so Richard McKenzie made the case that one of the sort of unspoken virtues of the free market and of capitalism is charity. It causes an increase in charity, at least in societies like the United States. And so if you're interested in some data on that topic, McKenzie put together some very interesting data, although it's kind of dated, of course, by now. Okay. And so one of the points that Mises makes is that social insurance taxes, the taxes that are imposed for so-called social insurance, whether it's unemployment insurance or other kinds of welfare, always ultimately come at the expense of the wage earner, even though they may be imposed on the employer. And here he's mentioning a basic tenet of mainstream economics as well as Austrian economics, in that when the government imposes a tax such as unemployment insurance or the Social Security tax, part of which is ostensibly on employers for the benefit of employees, it ultimately comes out of the pocket of the employee because the employer pays you less. And this is based on the marginal productivity theory of labor that all economists should be well schooled in. It says that in a capitalist marketplace, employers will pay you up to your marginal product of labor. And that is basically your contribution to revenue on an hourly basis or a weekly basis, whatever time period you want to choose. And so if you can contribute, say, $1,000 a week towards some enterprise, then it pays to pay you $900, $950, or something close to $1,000 a week as an employee. But it doesn't pay to pay you $1,100 a week if you can only produce, by participating in the enterprise, $1,000 a week. And so presumably employers do their best to pay you. Competition forces them to pay you about what your marginal product is. Because if my marginal product, for example, is $1,000 a week, but I'm being paid $100 a week, then there's a profit opportunity for another employer to pay me $200 a week, and then he can pocket the remaining $800 a week. And then there's still a profit incentive for someone else to pay me $300 or $400 or $500, because whenever there's a gap between marginal product and wages or wage compensation, it creates a profit opportunity for somebody to hire me away. And so that's how wages get bid up by competition between employers to roughly, equal to marginal productivity levels of the workforce. It's not a one-on-one correlation, but they do move together very strongly. And the stronger is the competition, the faster this adjustment occurs. And so whenever the government imposes these so-called mandated benefit taxes for unemployment insurance, Social Security, it's the wage earner that ultimately pays almost all of it, if not all of it, even though it's the average person is often fooled because it's not called a wage tax. It's called the employer contribution. And so Mises writes about this very clearly in Human Action. And he also makes the big point about how welfare causes a moral hazard problem. For example, take unemployment insurance again. It's been well known that Mises wrote about it. Many other mainstream economists, so-called, have written about it for decades. And that one of the moral hazard problems of unemployment insurance is that it causes more unemployment. In the United States today, I think it's around 2 years. Unemployment insurance lasts for 2 years. It differs, the amount you get differs state by state, but it's not unusual for it to be 60% or more of your previous income while you were employed. And so you can basically get a check for 60% or so in some states of what you were making, but you don't have to go to work. You don't have to get dressed. You don't have to spend money on gasoline or lunch or anything like that. And so surely that diminishes the incentive that people have to retool, retrain, get a new job. For example, during the housing market crash in the United States, the housing bubble that was created by the Fed sort of induced millions of people to get jobs or careers in mortgage finance, home repair, jobs at Home Depot and places like that, anything and everything related to the building and maintenance of houses. And then when the crash occurred, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of these jobs disappeared, and people were forced to retool, retrain, get a different type of job. But if you can just lounge around 2 years and make a decent amount of money enough to pay the bills, a lot of people are going to take advantage of that and are not going to be so vigorous in pursuing a new career or a new job. And so when the government measures the unemployment rate, one of the ingredients is the duration of unemployment, how long people are unemployed. And of course, with unemployment insurance being more generous and longer lasting, it increases the duration of unemployment so that the unemployment rate that you read about is higher. Whether it's the official government unemployment rate, or if you look up shadowstatistics.com and find out what the real unemployment rate is, if you use the formula that the government used 25 or 30 years ago, then it's not the 7.5% the government claims now. It's more like 14 or 15%. But either way, it's longer because of unemployment insurance. And that's one of the things von Mises is talking about here. And the way he put it, I wrote down this quote from his chapter. He said, "Social insurance has thus made the neurosis of the insured a dangerous public disease." And so he was very astutely talking about how behavior is changed in many ways by so-called social insurance or welfare. And it's not just that people stay unemployed longer. If welfare is generous enough, that people have enough to eat, they have housing subsidies and child care subsidies and so forth, then you do create the welfare trap. And we'll talk more about this next week. But you create a trap whereby, for example, if someone is in New York City making $40,000 a year in welfare benefits, cash and in-kind benefits, and they get a job, and as a result of getting a decent paying job, they lose most of those benefits, their marginal tax rate could be 60, 70, 80%. If you look at a tax, and not in terms of writing a check to the government, but losing benefits that government was giving you. That's a form of a tax. It's taking something away from you that you were given. And so who can blame a single mother with several children who's getting along, you know, not living lavishly, but getting along on welfare, to go and get a job, go to work, hire a babysitter, and pay a 70% marginal tax rate in the form of losing all her housing allowance, food stamps, and so forth. She's trapped in welfare. She's trapped there forever, and her children probably will be, and her grandchildren, if the system continues and maintains itself. And this is one of the things that Mises talks about. And it's not only that, but people's attitude changes too. When you don't have to get up for work, when you don't have to socialize with other people in an acceptable way, you don't have to show up for a job interview and look and get cleaned up, and you don't have to cooperate with other human beings in the workplace, it's easy to turn into a slob, especially us guys. And so many people do. You turn into a slob and a lazy slob. And so I'm not saying everyone does. But I think that's one of the things that Mises used the word neurosis there. And he was probably alluding to, even in his day, you know, many, many years ago when he wrote this, the welfare state in America was a tiny, tiny smidgen of what it is today. But I think he was recognizing these things also. And he also makes the important point that it is, of course, impossible to insure against unemployment. So the whole phrase unemployment insurance is sort of kooky, because you can't really insure against unemployment. It's just a giveaway of tax dollars to people who happen to be unemployed. And of course, let's not forget that the main reason for unemployment is the boom and bust cycle created by the Fed and other central banks, and also government interferences of wages in the form of minimum wage laws, laws that prop up unions that allow them to push wages up above competitive levels, things of that sort that keep wages from adjusting. For example, during the Great Depression, when there was a severe reduction in demand for goods and services, okay, there was also a reduction in demand for labor to produce those goods and services. And so the other way to keep your job, really, in a lot of industries, was to take a pay cut, because the companies didn't have the money to pay you the old wages. And so if your job is to be saved and the company is to be saved, everyone has to take a pay cut. And hopefully when the company is saved and the bust is over and we enter a growth period again, then competition will force wages back up. But if by governmental imposition the wages cannot go down, well, then you lose your job and the company may well go under. And that's what happened to a very large degree because of government policies during the 1930s, the so-called New Deal policies, minimum wage, maximum hour legislation, unemployment insurance, taxes, and so forth. There's a great book on this by Richard Vedder and Lowell Galloway called Out of Work, A History of Unemployment in America. That is an outstanding book on the history of unemployment in America. And it's very much from an Austrian perspective, and Murray Rothbard himself thought it was a tremendous book. And he in fact, was one of the early editors of the manuscript before it was published. Okay, so you have all this unemployment caused by government, the boom and bust cycle by the Fed, government interferences with wages, with regulations, laws, minimum wage laws, and so forth. And then when the unemployment arises because of government policy, it's always blamed on capitalism. That's inevitable that it's going to do that. And one other point that Meeseens makes here that I'd like to mention is he mentions the phrase capital consumption. Now, all the money, all the tax money that goes for the welfare state, the unemployment insurance, Social Security, and so forth, that's all money that is not available for capital investment, among other things. It's not available for private consumption either, but a very large part of it is not available for capital investment because it's spent now. It's used for current consumption because the government takes it and it hands it out to various groups of people who spend it now. And what that means is that if there's less capital investment because of what Mises calls capital consumption, then productivity of labor goes down. Because when we talk about capital investment, what are we talking about? We're talking about businesses investing in technology, machinery, computers, equipment, software, capital investment, real capital. And all of these things are done in a way that makes labor more productive. And to say that labor is more productive, it means labor becomes more valuable to employers. Because more productive means labor can produce more revenue for employers. So all of a sudden, in my old example of where I was worth $1,000 a week, given my productivity level, because of technological advancements that came at the expense of the investments made by my employer, and now I'm all of a sudden I'm worth $2,000 a week. And so my wages will be bid up in a competitive marketplace, maybe not all the way to $2,000, but they'll be more than $1,000. And so the lesson here is that capital investment increases labor productivity, and labor productivity increases, in turn, wages. The opposite is also true. Capital consumption, the diversion of capital expenditures from private entrepreneurs to government's current expenses, reverses that. It reduces capital investment, which reduces productivity growth and reduces wages. So this is the way in which, one sort of a hidden way in which the welfare state actually makes the working class poorer overall by creating a situation where the productivity of labor is at least slowed down, if not reversed, depending on how big the welfare state is. And so that's one of the things that is overlooked by a lot of mainstream economists also, and of course by the typical citizen who doesn't understand or has not studied economics. Now, to change gears a little bit, I've put an article or two on the syllabus about charity or helping the unemployed, helping the poor before the welfare state existed. And in the United States, up until around the late 1920s, 1930s, there was a proliferation of what were called mutual aid societies. And these were organizations of all kinds of societies. Many of them were ethnic, you know, the Jewish immigrants, Italian immigrants, Russian immigrants. There were a lot of African-American mutual aid societies because of discrimination. If African-Americans had trouble getting home loans or loans for their businesses, they started up their own banks and they started up their own mutual aid societies to help each other out. And they were so pervasive that by the 1920s, one-third of all adult men in America belonged to some mutual aid society, and where people paid dues, modest dues, and the dues revenues were used when you're in trouble. They actually ran a private unemployment insurance type program for the members of their societies. If you lost your job, you had help to put food on the table and to help to pay your rent and so forth and to find a job and so forth. They dominated health insurance at the time. Excuse me. Part of the dues went to purchasing group health insurance. And so and health insurance and health care was very much funded by these mutual aid societies. They found that dozens, if not hundreds, of hospitals and orphanages also. And so, you know, in his famous book, Democracy in America, Tocqueville wrote in the 1830s, of the penchant that these Americans seem to have. And he was a Frenchman. He wrote about the penchant that Americans seem to have to join all sorts of organizations and groups for charitable purposes. And so you fast forward a century past the time when Tocqueville wrote Democracy in America, and we really did have in the United States a mass proliferation of private charitable organizations. Another great example of this that still exists to this day is the Mormon Church poverty program. The Mormons have long had a program whereby if you're a member of the church and you're hit upon hard times, you lose your job, you're unemployed, major hospital bills for the children, things like that, they will help you. The church will help you. You'll have food. You'll have a roof over your head. But they're not like the government. They're very strict about it, in that you have to be also helping yourself, and you have to be educating yourself or looking for a job, or you can't be abusing alcohol or drugs or things like that. And many of these things are taboo with government welfare programs. And also, you're expected to help others in the future when they're in your situation, when they're in the same situation you were in when you had hard times. And so the Mormon Church does a good job. It's Rothbard writes about it in one of his essays in For a New Liberty, his essay that's on the reading list for next week, actually. And there was a great article on it many years ago, about 20 years ago, in Policy Review magazine. And I didn't have time to dig it up. I just popped into my head before the class. I couldn't think of where I read that article, but I'm pretty sure it was Policy Review magazine, published by the Heritage Foundation, maybe 20 or 25 years ago, about the Mormon private welfare program. And so this is the sort of thing that was displaced by the welfare state, and especially by the so-called New Deal of the 1930s. And of course, the welfare state in the United States did really get going with big, big money until the 1960s. Although one of the very first elements of welfareism in the United States was veterans' pensions after the Civil War. By the time you get to the 1870s, the government began spending a lot of money on veterans' pensions. That was probably the first big wide-scale federal welfare program in the United States. Now, Rothbard, I put this article, Rothbard's on the origins of the welfare state in the United States, and he takes a look at some of the explanations that sociologists and other mostly leftist academics have given for the welfare state, the origins, why we had it, why it came in big. And one cause, possible cause, poverty. But Rothbard points out that thanks to capitalism, poverty had been declining for generations. And poverty was, you know, today the poverty level is arbitrarily defined by the U.S. government. It's ridiculous. It's, you know, what is it, a family of four that makes $27,000 a year? It's just an arbitrary number. The way that number was actually invented was somebody at the U.S. Department of Agriculture did a calculation of how many calories it would take to be healthy, to not have health problems related to lack of food. And then they calculated how much money it would take to buy that, you know, that amount of food, and they multiplied it by four, not 4.5, not 3.9, but four, and that became the official poverty rate in the United States. And so it's just an arbitrary number, and it has changed, but poverty had been declining for many, many years. In fact, the book that I mentioned before the class, Losing Ground by Charles Murray, one of the things the book is famous for is the charts that are in the book that show that all in the post-World War II era in the United States, all throughout the 1950s and the early part of the 1960s, thanks to economic growth, thanks to capitalism, the poverty rate was declining. And by the time you get those in the late 60s and early 70s, it took a sharp turn up because of the advent of the welfare state, the big money put behind the welfare state, and all of the bad work incentives that were created by the welfare state. But that's mostly the topic for next week. So poverty is not a good explanation for why we have a welfare state. Inequality, the old socialists saw about inequality. But capitalism had also been reducing inequality, too, as far as that goes. There's no, and also there are other countries that have different levels of inequality, more inequality and less inequality, that also have welfare states. So you don't really see a direct causation, or you can't make an argument for a direct causation between inequality and the advent of a welfare state. And then there's one argument that labor unions were instrumental. But as Rothbard points out, labor unions in the United States in the private sector are never more than about 30% of the private sector. Today in the United States, they're probably maybe 7 or 8% of the private sector workforce. But they were never big enough and powerful enough to create, to be responsible for the welfare state, he argues. And so what Rothbard does come up with in terms of why we had the development of the welfare state is a bootleggers and Baptist type theory. I've mentioned this theory, the bootleggers and Baptist theory, in a number of articles of mine on the web. And there's a YouTube video by the economist Bruce Yandel that explains bootleggers and Baptist theory. And the origins of this phraseology was Bruce Yandel, spelled Y-A-N-D-L-E. He explained prohibition, alcohol prohibition, as being a result of lobbying efforts by bootleggers and Baptists. Or maybe not the origins of it, but the maintenance of it. Why it lasted so long from roughly, what was it, 1919 until 1933, I think, was alcohol prohibition in the United States. Now, the bootleggers were the people who were illegally selling, transporting and selling the booze. And so they wanted prohibition to last because they would be out of business and out of money if alcohol was legalized. And the Baptist, so-called, was just sort of a symbol for the religious people, such as the Women's Christian Temperance Union, who were just opposed to alcohol consumption for religious reasons. So there was a coalition of sort of these ideologues, Christian ideologues, and people who were all about the money, the bootleggers. And Rothbard makes this explanation for the advent of the welfare state. where he says there is a combination of, in his words, ideology and economic interest. And this really does explain so much in American economic history, the combination of ideology and economic interest. Who were the ideologues? Among the ideologues were what Rothbard calls the helping professions. There was already a young social work profession, people trained in sociology, social work, and so forth. And so they began proselytizing in the media as opinion makers, as academics for the institutions of a welfare state. And of course, Germany is credited with having the first welfare state under Bismarck in the 19th century, the late 19th century. And then Rothbard goes into quite a bit of detail on the importance, as he has in several publications, on the importance of a new type of Protestantism that came to dominate American politics, mostly in the northern states, beginning in the 1820s and all through the 19th century. He calls it Pietist Protestantism, and this dominated the Whig Party, which existed from the 1830s to the 1850s, and then later the Republican Party. It was the Democratic Party. It was the party of Jefferson, of peace and free trade, and limited constitutional government. It was the Republican Party. It was always a party of big government, corporate welfare, for the most part, and crony capitalism. And what these Pietists believed in was that in order for themselves to be saved, to go to heaven, then they needed to bring a 1,000-year kingdom of God on earth. And to do that, they had to eradicate sin. And to eradicate sin, they had to use government to eradicate sin. And I wrote down one of the quotes from this chapter describing one of the prominent intellectuals, Richard T. Ely, who was the co-founder of the American Economic Association. This is his describing his attitude, was that this, quote, government was the God-given instrument through which we had to work. So they wanted to create heaven on earth through government interventionism. And this is a very powerful impetus. Richard T. Ely, after all, was a co-founder of the American Economic Association, and he was a very prominent academic. And there were also many other prominent academics who were Pietists. Irving Fisher, one of the founders of the Chicago School of Economics, was of that mindset. And so this attitude was mostly dominant in the northern states of the United States, but that's who controlled the government of the United States from the end of the Civil War, to this day almost. It was the New England Yankees, who were sort of the descendants of the early Puritans, who primarily adopted this mindset. And Rothbard writes about the Women's Christian Temperance Union as Yankee women. And now the phrase Yankee referred to a particular type of person, mostly from the northern United States, but not exclusively. And this is a type of person who believed that he or she was morally superior to others and had some sort of God-given right to force others to behave more like them. My old friend Clyde Wilson, the historian Clyde Wilson, once said that Hillary Clinton would be a museum-quality specimen of a Yankee. So it's not just people from the northern states. It's people from the northern states who had this sort of imperious, totalitarian mindset of moral superiority and some sort of right that comes from somewhere to use the coercive powers of government to force everyone else to be more like you. And these were the people who dominated the early government institutions such as the Children's Bureau. This was in the 1920s, one of the first federal government institutions of the welfare state, the Children's Bureau. There was a Maternity and Infancy Protection Act in 1921. Which sounds, if you read about it, it sounds very creepy indeed, where social workers, government-paid social workers, were subsidized by the federal government to remove children from, quote, inadequate homes. So the government gave itself the right to determine, apparently, what an inadequate home is and could take your children and put them somewhere else, into an orphanage or somewhere else. There was the Women's Trade Union League that was formed, and many of these people became prominent New Dealers. They worked for Franklin Roosevelt and were appointees. And you can read the article, Rothbard's article, as well as I can. But this is a classic Murray Rothbard power elite analysis of the origins of the welfare state, where he does something that no mainstream economist would ever do. That is, he worked very hard. He worked very hard, did a tremendous amount of reading about, well, just who are these people who Franklin Roosevelt put in charge of all these these new welfare state agencies of the government. And so he looked into the biographies that exist of all of these people to tell you who they were, what their thinking was, what their ideology was. And so you can tell a story about how ideology played such an important part in creating these institutions. And of course, they were married to big business too. Big business at the time in the early 20th century, especially big businesses that made so much money as war profiteers during World War I, saw that they could benefit very handsomely by being associated with big government. And a good example of this is how large corporations were all in favor of the Social Security tax when Social Security came into being in the 1930s. Small businesses opposed it generally. And the reason was given by the big business, the big corporations, is that most of the big corporations already had some sort of pension plan for their employees. So they're already spending pension money for their employees as a fringe benefit. But a lot of small companies, startup companies, new companies, weren't. They didn't have the capital to do it, and so they weren't offering these things. And that gave them a competitive edge in terms of lower cost of production. So the big companies, when they saw the way in which Social Security would be financed, and that, you know, the employer contribution of, say, you know, 7%, and then the employee 7%, well, that's a big new tax that they were glad to pay, because they would just take that out of their employee's paycheck. So they thought it would burden the competition more. It would be a bigger burden on the smaller companies, and probably also a deterrent to the formation of newer, smaller companies also. And so they were in favor. And so that's a good example of how there was the wedding of big business and ideologues, left-wing ideologues and big business, to get the welfare state started. Now, the next thing I'd like to mention here is how, the advocates of the welfare state are always telling us that what government does is try to make things more equal, that it's all about egalitarianism. We want to transform society, Obama says, who I refer to as the Marxist in the White House, the proud Marxist in the White House. And so that's the ideology. It's always been the ideology of socialism, egalitarianism. And so, but if you look at what government actually does to poor people or lower income people, then much of what it does is actually harmful to poor people, despite all the rhetoric about helping poor people. Minimum wage laws cause unemployment among the least skilled, least educated workers by pricing them out of a job. If a teenager can only contribute $5 an hour by standing at the window at McDonald's and serving hamburgers and french fries, and the government tells McDonald's they must pay him $8 an hour, well, then it is no longer profitable for McDonald's to employ that teenager. And so the people with the least income and least education are the ones who suffer most, because if you have a little more experience, you're probably worth $8, $9, $10 an hour. You're more productive. We all get more productive the longer we do things. So it's the younger people, the more inexperienced people, who are hurt the most by minimum wage law. Maximum hour laws also. How does that help the poor to have maximum hour laws if a man or a woman wants to be a go-getter and work long hours to support his or her family, but the government says no? the government got involved in urban renewal in the 60s. That pretty much meant bulldozing poor neighborhoods, sustainable, vibrant neighborhoods with shops, grocery stores, bars, low-income houses. They weren't fancy, they weren't exotic, but they were decent, lower to lower middle class neighborhoods. There's a book about this by Martin Anderson called The Federal Bulldozer, about with the creation of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The government went in and literally bulldozed square miles of cities, Washington, D.C., and all over the country, and in the place of these viable low-income neighborhoods, they put these hideously ugly prison-like public housing, crime-riddled, drug-infested public housing projects, which some of them within 10 or 15 years, the government was blowing up with dynamite because they'd become so decrepit and rebuilding them. That was called urban renewal. Then there's occupational licensing laws that keep lower income, especially, away from all sorts of occupations. Out in the American West, the government, through the Bureau of Reclamation, subsidizes water. You know, they have water issues in California, especially. The federal government massively subsidizes agricultural corporations at the expense of making water even more expensive and more scarce to people in the urban areas. And that's where most of the lower income people live, in the urban areas. So that harms them too. The public utilities were all set up as government-created monopolies for the past 100 years or more. That creates, in essence, a regressive tax. If you have to pay more for electricity and natural gas, water supply, because it's run by a government monopoly or a private regulated monopoly, well, that's a regressive tax in that it imposes a disproportionate harm on lower income people. The Social Security tax is regressive. So are sales taxes. Donald Trump pays the same sales tax on a loaf of bread as does the poorest person in America. It's a regressive tax. The zero interest rate policy of the Fed that it's been pursuing abolishes any chance that any low-income person has of saving money and earning a little bit of interest income on money. The government school monopoly is a disaster for the poor in America, and especially the inner-city African-American poor. If you have the money to send your kids to private school or move out to an affluent suburb, or even the public schools are better, then you can escape. But if not, the poorest of the poor who are harmed the most. Farm agricultural price supports are another regressive tax, propping up the price of food for the benefits of winning votes from farmers. Zoning causes housing prices to go up. That hurts the poor disproportionately. And so all of these things, this is the short list of government policies that are all regressive, all harm the poor. And then the government says, we will come to your rescue. We will give you a check. We will send you welfare. It's sort of the same attitude the government has toward poor people in developing countries, where they impose protectionism for the first part and prohibit them from selling very much of their agricultural goods or other goods here in the United States. And then we give them foreign aid. We throw them a few crumbs in foreign aid, which is also is a form of corporate welfare because it's usually in-kind aid or a match or has some sort of attachment where, okay, we'll send you tractors for your farmers, but they have to be international harvester tractors. And so international harvesters get to sell a lot of tractors. And that's foreign aid. And so what the point here is that, all of these government institutions are very clearly harmful to the poor, even though the government turns around then and says, we are here to help you. We're here to help the poor. And the final point I'd like to make is I wrote down a few of the what I consider to be premises of welfareism, sort of the basic fundamental premises of it. And premise number one would be paternalism. And basically what this means is that you are assumed, you know, the masses of the public are assumed to be incapable of taking care of themselves. But at the same time, as Lysander Spooner pointed out generations ago, the same people who are assumed to be so feeble-minded and so incapable that they can't feed themselves are sort of geniuses when it comes to voting. That when they vote in the politicians that run these programs, well, they're perfectly capable. They're perfectly, you know, very well educated and capable of doing that, but you can't take care of yourself. The second premise is political plunder. Now, what welfareism is all about, when it comes down to it, is the point that it is illegal to use cash to pay people to vote for you in the United States. Politicians can't hire people to go out and say, here's $20, vote for me. But they can give you a government job, they can give you a government grant, they can buy votes indirectly in all kinds of ways. And so basically the game is that politicians promise to give you some of somebody else's money if you vote for them. It's the old game of concentrated government benefits and dispersed pot. Tax each taxpayer $5 and then give lavish benefits to very politically active interest groups like farmers or labor unions or sugar farmers in Louisiana and Florida who get price supports on sugar and things like that. And so it's political plunder. Premise number three is slavery is okay as long as you call it social justice or democracy. And by slavery, I think you know, the definition of what the welfare state is about is forcing one person with a threat of punishment and imprisonment to work for the benefit of another person. What else would you call that but slavery? If you refuse to pay your income taxes to finance the welfare state and the warfare state, government will force you to live in a cage, a 5-foot by 5-foot cage with a toilet and no doors for 5, 6, 7 years or so as punishment. And so you literally are a slave if you refuse to work for the benefit of somebody else. And that's called social justice. Premise number four is that moral hazard is pervasive. You pay people to not work, you're going to destroy at least part of their work ethic. And if you do this long enough, it creates quite a catastrophe. There was a book written by a sociologist about 10 years ago about unemployment in the city of Chicago. And one of the premises of this book was that there was a whole generation of lower income people in some neighborhoods in Chicago who have never had any contact with an adult male who got up and went to work in the morning, because the welfare state has so destroyed families in cities like Chicago that you have entire generations who have had no role models, no uncles, fathers, cousins, who are just guys who get up and go to a job in the morning and who could teach the children and nephews what it's like, what you need to do to be a responsible employed person. And so that's a moral hazard effect of several generations of welfare statism. And premise number five, in summary, this is the last thing I'll mention here, is capital consumption. The welfare state is all about consuming now capital, much capital that could have been used to invest in the future. And that slows down productivity growth. It makes us all poorer, not to mention it deprives us of the fruits of capital investment, which is better products, cheaper products, and more innovative products that we could use to make our lives better. Okay, and that's about the points I wanted to make for now. And so I've been talking for about 50 minutes. Sorry about the coughing, my voice, my throat's a little dry tonight. but I'll be glad to answer any questions or do my best anyway. If I see Cam has been doing his usual great job of adding links to the things I say, If anyone has a question on Q&A or the chat, feel free. There's no requirement, but if you have anything you'd like to say, feel free, and I'll do my best to answer. Let's see, Malcolm wants to know if anyone has written on how unions increase claim time or claim frequency for unemployment insurance. There is actually a pretty big literature in economics on unemployment insurance. It shouldn't be too hard to find it. I know there have been all kinds of studies, for example, on how the building construction trades, like housing construction, since in the northern, in places like Michigan or Wisconsin, where it's just too cold to build houses for much of the year, people are on unemployment insurance. And so what that does is to subsidize, in an indirect way, the housing construction industry, because you don't have to worry about retooling and retraining people who lost their jobs because it's wintertime. You can hire back the same people who have been getting along on unemployment insurance all the way along. And so that tends to increase the overall unemployment rate, because it's a way of subsidizing these cyclical industries that are volatile due to such things as weather in the northern states. And so I know if you were to look at the Journal of Labor Research. The Journal of Labor Research was edited for many years by my old friend James Bennett. He's no longer the editor, but he published many, many articles over the years in the Journal of Labor Research on the role of unions and unemployment insurance and things of that sort. And so, one of the best known Austrian friendly economists who's written on labor is Morgan Reynolds. So I would also look up the books by Morgan Reynolds. One of them is Power and Privilege, and it's about labor unions. And so so you might look there if you want to find out the answer to this question. And a lot of students just rely on the videotape, especially on a Sunday night class, I suppose, and when there's football on television. So we might not have too many live students asking questions. Let's see. I'll write in my email. Let's see. And Malcolm has another question, how capital raises wages. Sure. Capital investment raises wages because it makes labor more productive, not capital, makes labor more productive. A farm worker, when the tractor was invented, a farm worker all of a sudden became orders of magnitude more productive because if he could drive the tractor instead of walking behind a team of horses, he could plow maybe 100 times more land per day. And so the key to understanding this is understanding that there's competition between employers, and not just employers in that business. A farm worker can work in a factory, can work in a store, can work in a lot of places. So we've always had thousands of opportunities, alternatives for employment. And so if you're productive because of the capital investment of an employer, businesses, mostly in your industry, will compete for your services by offering you higher wages if you're being exploited. And economic exploitation means being paid significantly less than your marginal product. And so that's one of the principal tenets of Austrian economics. Read the chapter on work and wages in Human Action by Ludwig von Mises for a much more in-depth explanation. But it's not that much more in-depth. It's not, you don't need to read 100 pages to understand this. But if you really want to see what the master himself had to say, look at the chapter on work and wages in Human Action. Yeah, the marginal productivity theory, the marginal means additional. Kay has a question here. Marginal means additional. Marginal productivity means the addition to output produced by each laborer. So when McDonald's hires another worker, and that worker produces $5 an hour worth of hamburger sales, that person's marginal or additional product is $5 an hour. So it's worth paying that person, say, $4.50 an hour. McDonald's will pocket 50 cents for every hour that person is working. But if the government says you have to pay that person $6 an hour, then it is no longer profitable to pay that person to work at McDonald's. Robert is asking about amnesty. I assume he means illegal immigrant amnesty. Well, you know, for a long, long time, I've been watching the Democrats salivating over the prospect of enrolling, you know, say there are 11 million illegal immigrants who are made citizens. Well, maybe probably, what if 4 million are on welfare? Oh, that's 4 million guaranteed votes. More than 4 million, because every adult that's on welfare, if he has adult children over the age of 18, they're going to vote too for the party that is the champion of welfare. And the Republicans apparently think that they can do their corporate supporters give them a benefit with cheaper labor, with more immigrants. And then, of course, they want to lord over the welfare state too. They're dumb enough to think that people will vote for them if they hand out the welfare checks. And so, the big debate among economists over this, among mainstream economists, is usually all about, how many immigrants will be on welfare and what will they do? Will they work or on welfare? But the fact is, you know, most will work eventually, but still many millions will also be on welfare, just like the general population. And so, sure, it'll be an expansion of the welfare state, and it will invite even more people to come and get on welfare. It essentially opens up every American's, working American's paycheck to anybody in the world. That's why a lot of mainstream economists are opposed to open borders immigration policy as long as we have a welfare state. This includes Gary Becker, the Nobel Prize winner. It includes the late Milton Friedman, the famous African-American libertarian, Walter Williams is opposed to open borders. Thomas Sowell is opposed to open borders. And so it's not just some Austrians who I have qualms about this. There are other Austrian economists I know of who are in favor of open borders immigration policy, because they'll tell you that immigration policy is a separate issue. And so, but of course, the free flow of labor is part of the free market. And so you have a difference of opinion on this. Actually, the Journal of Libertarian Studies seven, 8 years ago, published the whole issue on the pros and cons of the open borders immigration policy. And Robert wants to know when the giant welfare state will collapse. Well, I think we're seeing it now, aren't we? Because the government doesn't have enough money to pay for it. There's a $1 trillion deficit. And so there is no more money. The government can't borrow forever. I mean, people at some point, the Chinese and others are going to quit buying the government bonds, and that's when the welfare state will collapse. It's already happening. It's happening sooner rather than later in Europe, in many countries in Europe, Greece and Spain and places like that. And so I don't know when, but I think we're about to witness it. Okay, Robert has Sunday dinner. Good, have bon appetit. Let's see, Malcolm asks if anyone's read on veteran benefits used as a seeding point for other types of benefits. I don't know. I know what pops into my head is the book Emancipating Slaves, Enslaving Free Men by Jeffrey Hummel discusses this near the end of his book. He discusses how the Civil War, the American Civil War, one of the effects of it was the creation of sort of the first welfare class in America in terms of veteran benefits. And Hummel usually has lots and lots of footnotes in his writing. So if you really want to get an answer, that's one place I would look if I were to look for a question, an answer to that question about the origin of veteran benefits and their effects. Well, we seem to be running out of gas. Let's see. There's another one. Yeah, Beto does talk about how lobbying by medical societies, hospitals, government institutions, and so forth were successful in essentially destroying many of the mutual aid societies. Banking industry did not like it that they were getting into the banking business, for example. And so it was special interest politics that destroyed a lot of it. And then they were displaced by government programs in later decades. And Adrian says the only way to not be a slave is not earn income. Well, there have been libertarians who believe that. The late Carl Hess, who was a famous libertarian in the 1960s and 70s, actually lived on barter. He moved out to West Virginia and he lived somehow on barter and he tried to have as little cash income as possible. But that's a tough life. And Malcolm wants to know about something to read about the PhD's work with the Pietists, Murray Rothbard's writings, all throughout his writings, including his essay, World War One as Fulfillment. It's online, World War One as Fulfillment. It gives chapter and verse of the connection between big business and the Pietists in America. Yeah, Kay wants to know who's left the tax. Well, that's a good question. It's the middle class is always the most heavily taxed because that's where the money is. And so what you're going to see if you're wealthy enough, you can leave the country, you can buy citizenship someplace. Used to be able to do that in Switzerland fairly easily if you were wealthy, not so much anymore. But it's the working people, the working middle class that will be taxed to death unless they revolt. Malcolm is reading Atlas Shrugged. Ayn Rand always said that Mises was her favorite economist and the Austrian school was her favorite school of thought on economics. So Rand was influenced by Mises. Murray Rothbard was actually a part of Ayn Rand's inner circle in New York City when he was a young man. And he got kicked out of the inner circle because Ayn Rand was a rather belligerent atheist. And Murray had, even though Murray was not a believer, he married a Christian. Joey Rothbard was a Christian. And for that reason, Ayn Rand kicked Murray out of the inner circle of the Ayn Rand group. Now, Ayn Rand has a little book called Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal. It's a very good series of essays. They're dated, of course, and they're not all essays by Ayn Rand. Alan Greenspan has his famous essay on the gold standard in that book. But Ayn Rand does cite Ludwig von Mises in several places in that book, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. Well, it looks like we're running out of gas here, and it's getting close to dinner time, I guess. So maybe we'll cut it off there. I guess thank you for participating, and I hope you all learned something. And we'll try it again next week. We'll go into the economic effects of welfareism in much more detail next week.